All right. Well, with that, would you please join me in welcoming Patrick to our stage?
Beautiful. Patrick Guthrie, alcoholic. It's a pretty nice setup here. You know, it's got a. Who's the sound guy? Can you add a little bass, please? You know, I'm. No, I'm kidding. He knew it. He's also an Al-Anon. Would you give me a cup of coffee, too? You know? Just kidding. He's bigger than I am. Yeah. So I'm from Lompoc, and if you're wondering where that's at, that is between Santa Barbara and Pismo Beach, which is geographically correct. Sounds pretty nice, huh? But it's really like Bakersfield West, so it's kind of... that doesn't go over when you're up this close to Bakersfield, I know. But, it was a beautiful drive up, and as I was coming into the city, I saw... I had no idea. I've never been to Visalia before, and... I came in and I saw the dairies, and I thought, okay, it's a farm town, and then I smelled the dairies, and I really got it, and then I drove in, and it's a big burg. This is a city. It's beautiful, and everything's so new. It's like they went through a building something or other, but everything looked really new, and I want to thank my friends Karen and Dale for paying for my Marie calendar tonight. That was really good, and that banana cream pie was ooh la la. You don't need to drink when you got that, you know what I mean? And my buddy Bob for coming up here. There was a little mix-up and some paperwork, so we ended up driving up separately, which was kind of strange, but that was cool. And he's my wheel man. He pretty much drives me anywhere. He likes to drive a lot. And I met Bob at CMC, which is a California men's colony in a prison. And ever since they let him out, the guy can't drive enough. I mean, really, he's like, where are you going to go? Let's go. He's like my dog. I got a little miniature dachshund. And anytime he thinks he's going to go for a ride, he, like, gets all crazy and wants to go. And it was a... actually pees all over the place. I'm glad Bob doesn't do that, you know. I mean, at least I don't see it. I mean, I'm not like actually looking at it, but my daughter calls it happy pee. I don't know, I just call it, you ruined the carpet, you little son of a gun, you know. And and I want to thank the world famous Jack B for coming up here from Three Rivers, who I knew from Lompoc, and he moved up here a few years ago, and thanks, Jack, for making the drive over. I appreciate that. I also want to welcome Justin, Margaret, and Jessica, but I think there were some other newcomers, and if I missed you, I'm sorry. And it is really an honor and a privilege to be here. I want to thank Bill for asking me to share tonight. He isn't here. Thanks a lot, Bill. And but he said he was going to listen to the tape, so I'll make sure and really, you know... drop a lot of F-bombs and talk about drugs and, you know what I mean, things that really, like, turn up the AA fires, you know. I think I've got, like, 2 hours here, right? I'm just kidding. Like, yeah, all right, man. No, but I've got about 40 minutes. I'm going to, like, jump right into it So I went to Catholic school, and today is Ash Wednesday, you know, for those Catholics out there, you know, and later on it became Hash Wednesday for me, I don't know, you know, it was like, can you get any of that good stuff? I went to, I don't want to offend anybody, but I probably will offend everybody by the end of the night. And so I went to Catholic school, and I went to, we had to go to church every day. It was pretty much mandatory, and the nuns were always on the lookout, make sure you weren't touching yourself, you know, things like that. And the priests were on the lookout, too, but that's a whole other story. And, and my mom and dad were involved in this thing called this charismatic movement, and they had these prayer meetings over at our house. And they would speak in tongues, and it was just pretty bizarre to me. But you know what I liked about it was I got to play music. I played guitar. And so I went to those meetings so I could play music. I really enjoyed playing music. And So here's what was going on, though, is my dad was molesting my sister and I. And I don't remember when it started. I know that it happened late at night, and I really have tried through regressive therapy and a lot of things to pinpoint the start of it, but I don't know. It just seemed like it was happening all the time. And this is how it went. He would come in and he would say, "This is wrong. Don't tell your mom. I'm really sorry. This is the last time." And I, "Oh, okay, it's the last time." And then the next night it would be the same thing. And the next night. And that pretty much went on that way until I left home at 17. And what this did for me was I didn't trust anybody. I didn't trust any male authority figures. First it started, I didn't trust him. I didn't believe anything that he said. And every time I had a chance, I would embarrass him or take my shot at him. And then it went over to, like, the principal, the teachers, the coaches. And then later on it went to the police. And then it went to the Drug Enforcement Agency and the judges. And then, you know, that whole thing. I didn't trust anybody. And also this thing went over into my relationship with women, too. I just didn't trust any women. I couldn't. I would talk the talk, but I just, in my heart, I knew that you couldn't trust anybody. And really what that does for someone like me, besides being this really crucify me on the cross, I'm a victim, it makes me, not trust myself either. And so, as I went through school, I ran cross country and track, and I know it's hard to believe, but this is what happens when you stop running, you know, and when your knees are blown out, you know, and you keep eating like you're running 10, 20 miles a day, but, you know, it's the pie, and that was really kind of a substitute for me for using and drinking, you know, and I did everything. I drank a lot, and I never even, I'll tell you the truth is, I never considered alcohol a problem. I didn't. I mean, I considered heroin a problem. Like that, yeah, I could see that I was, like, having problems with it, but alcohol was like a breakfast beverage, you know what I mean? And so it wasn't, like, that big of a deal until I tried to stop. And it seems like I always focused so much on the drugs. I did. I was like, if I could just not use the drugs, I'd be okay, but I could keep drinking. And what happened for me was when I would drink, all my inhibitions would lower down and I would be right back on all the drugs again. So I've got this not, I don't trust anybody. I'm pretty much pissed off at the world. I mean, I'm angry. I don't even know if I could fully express my anger today, but I will tell you that I joined a punk rock band. I was really into the whole punk rock scene. It just seemed like a natural thing for me. We were awesome. You probably heard of us, Anorexic Sacrifice. No, we sucked, but it was punk rock. Who cares, right? And it was loud, it was fast, and it was foul. And I'm going to share just a little point of, like, a day in the life of Patrick Guthrie, lead singer for Anorexic Sacrifice, right? I was living in Springfield, Missouri at the time, and I was actually in college. I mean, I was in college, but I didn't go to many classes. I was mainly there to sell weed and drugs to the frat guys, and I had this band thing going because I knew we were going to be famous, or I don't know, but we were playing this gig in Austin, Texas, by this time, my grandmother had cancer, okay, and that's when I kind of got started on the pills. She had terminal cancer for 14 years. It was like she was, every 6 or 8 months, she was on a respirator about to die, and it was a hardship on the family. I personally found it to be quite convenient, you know, because I'd love to go see Grandma. I would tell my mom, you know, this is, hey, can we go see Grandma? She said, "Oh, you want to see your Grandma, honey?" I'm like, "Yeah." And I would run right to the bathroom. I'd open up the medicine cabinet. It was like, woohoo! You know what I mean? It was beautiful. And I didn't even know what I was taking at the time, but in the beginning, I would just take them, and I would wait. see what was going to happen, you know? I mean, sometimes I would pass out, and I mean, one time I pissed blood, and I thought, oh, don't take those anymore. They were like blood thinners. You don't want to take those, and you don't get high on them. And so I finally got smart, and I started to read the bottles, and it said, don't operate heavy machinery. All right, where's the bulldozer? You know what I mean? I'm ready to go. And don't mix with alcohol. Oh, that's a keeper, you know. Don't drink and drive with these. And I'm like, oh, yeah, right. And so I got that thing going, and that's kind of how I got started on that whole drug thing. So I want to fast forward to this trip we took to Austin, Texas to play. There was like 30 bands. It was a big, big show. We were the first to go on, which means we sucked pretty much. And we, Springfield to Austin, Texas is like its own country. It's just you driving and driving. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there? No, shut up! You know, it's like forever you're driving. And by this time, I've really liked Captain Morgan's Spice Rum. You know, I really like that. You know, it was like, it was great. I like all the alcohol names, you know what I mean? Wild Turkey, you know what I mean? It was like Everclear, like that's really going to be right, you know what I mean? How about Old Granddad? Come on up here, son. Sit on my lap, tell me your problems, you know what I mean? I like all those, but Captain Morgan's, I just wanted to wear a patch and go for it. And I was drinking that, and by this time I'm doing these number four dilaudids. They're pretty hardcore pills, and I'm shooting them up, and we're driving, and what happened was we pull into Austin, which seemed like we were driving for 3 days, and I thought, hey man, we haven't eaten for 2 days, maybe three. You know, and they're like, yeah, let's drive through and get something to eat. We're going to be late. And I'm like, no, it'll be all right. And so we drove through this Burger King. I swallowed this Whopper in like 3 bites, went in the bathroom, did up my thing, and we pull into the gig. And it's at the VFW in Austin, Texas, the Veterans of Foreign War. I've got to tell you, the Texas veterans don't truly appreciate the punk rock movement. They really don't. In fact, they were like, what the hell's wrong with you, boy? And I'm like, yeah, no problem. So the guy that was kind of running the thing, and I think he was tweaked out of his mind. He's like, dude, you're late, man. There's not enough time for you to warm up. I'm like, we don't need to warm up, man. We're fine. Just get, point us up there. And so we get up there, and there's a couple hundred people, and the venue was huge. By the way, you know, Bill did tell me there'd be more people here. I thought I was going to be able to give my talk on humility tonight, but there just isn't enough people. But there wasn't enough people there last night either. So anyway, so I get there and all the punk rockers are kind of out at the back doing their punk rock thing, and we come up in there and there's like nobody's going to be listening to us. We're up on stage, and there's only like four or five neo-Nazi skinheads that are actually going to, and I'm not even sure they're going to listen. I think they're going to heckle. So they're right there, and we're thrashing, you know, family man, with your life so planned, I'd like to crucify you to your front door with nails from your well-stocked garage. Right? But the one skinhead was like, I could see he was really getting one from down deep, and he let it flip. Oh, sorry for that, Peter. And he let it fly, and it was like it was coming at me, slow motion. I was powerless to move out of its path, and it hit me in the face. It wasn't so much the texture, which was nasty, I'll tell you. It was like the smell. Oh my God! And all of a sudden, you know, the Captain Morgan's was like, argh! And the Dilaudid was like, and the Whopper was like, and I Godzilla'd on these guys, right? I mean, it was like something out of a movie, you know, right? And the guy who took the main brunt of the shot was picking tomato out of his ear, you know, he wasn't done too happy. He reached up and he pulled me off the stage. He started to pummel me, right? And I knew I was taking damage because I couldn't see out of this eye anymore. And I saw the like, poosh, poosh, poosh. But I wasn't feeling anything, you know? I mean, I was like, finally the bouncers came and they pulled this Neanderthal off of me. By the way, the band never stopped playing. I'm like, They threw me back up on stage, and I'm crawling, I'm bleeding, I'm messed up. And all the people at the back, they're all like, oh, dude, somebody just puked and's getting their ass kicked. Punk rock! And they all come running up, right? And it went down in punk rock lore. It was awesome. It was the greatest show ever, at least for me. In fact, every show we ever played after that, there was, because it was went around the little click punk rock, you could hear it out in the crowd. They're like, puke, 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 puke. Even my bass player's like, dude, you think you could puke again? That thing worked for us, you know? And for me, it was like, it was something we laughed about. It was like no big deal. It was all of the chaos. All of the, I owe this guy money and I've got a front out from this guy and this guy, and all that chaos of dealing and I'm playing and the alcohol and all the pressure. It was just, it was overwhelming. And the only way I could really deal drugs was to be basically more or less insanely drunk. That was kind of what it was like. And so about, 4 or 5 months later, 6 months later, I was, a guy called me up and said, a guy that I dealt a lot of drugs to, said, hey, come on up to St. Louis and bring everything you got. I got a guy that's going to buy it all. And I drove up there in the Anarchy Mobile. It was really the Felony Mobile. And, no, it was like a Galaxy 500 with an Anarchy sign spray painted on the side. It was like, I'm carrying drugs, pull me over. You know what I mean? But somehow I made it there. And I got into the motel room, and the guy was late with the money. He finally got there. He handed me the cash, and I'm jonesing by this time. I'm like, I got it. I need to take care of business. And I just fanned through the bills, and he goes, don't you want to count it? I trust you, man. I got to go. And he's like, not so fast. What would your mom say if she saw you now? I'm like, my mom? What the hell are you talking about? And then, bang, all the doors came in. Everybody on the ground now, freeze! And I was 22 years old, and I couldn't believe it. My heart was beating so hard when they handcuffed me that I was actually lifting up off the floor, you know? And I thought my life was over. I remember, that wasn't my first run-in with the law. It wouldn't be my last either. But that was like the moment. It was a key moment in my life. And I remember calling up my mom and dad. And I want to share the story, and I rarely do. But I was at a meeting where it was half Al-Anon, half AA, and I hate speaking at those things. And because the Al-Anon always goes first, and all right, you both get 30 minutes, okay? And the Al-Anon goes for 50, and you get 10, you know. And I even raised a point about it with the people, and because my ego, you know, whatever. And but this, I realized at that point why I didn't like it, because this lady was talking about her daughter, and about this phone call that I made, and this is what it sounded like. This call is from a, you know, state correctional institution, you know, like, mom, oh my God, what happened? I go, I've been arrested. I need you guys to help me out. Let me get your father. You know, my dad gets on the line, and they said, hey, I've been arrested. I need some help. And there was a long pause. I could hear my mom crying in the background. And my dad said something to me that I tell you what, I'll never forget. He said, I'm sorry, son. We can't help you anymore. You're on your own. And he hung up. Now, at the time, I thought, that son of a bitch. This is... It's his fault, you know, because I blamed him for everything. I was a free spirit roaming the cosmos, and you two had to screw and bring me down here. I mean, really, that's how much I blame them. I mean, I blame them for my birth to the point at that time of my life, 22 years of pain and agony they caused me. And how dare him hang up on me when I needed them. But also I knew, like, oh, shoot, man, mom and dad are out. I'm done. And I want to tell you that that's why I hate listening to Al-Anon. Or I did. because I just, that pain that I caused my mom and dad, I could never get in touch with. The pain that I caused others because of my alcoholism. So I want to tell you that I was an informant for the DEA. That's how I got out of it. And I didn't have to go to jail. And I was a rat, and I hated it. I did. And I wore a wire, and some people went to prison. And I tell you, that thing really, it hurt me. It did. And I want you to know that it's so funny because I do a lot of H&I now. I go into the federal penitentiary in Lompoc. I go to CMC. I have the honor and privilege of going into Atwater. I've been to more prison sober than I ever was at when I was using. What happened was at about 10 or 11 years sober. Oh, by the way, I got sober in 1986. I'll be celebrating. I'm 24 years sober. I was 23 when I got sober. If you're young, you can do it. All right. Don't think that you're too young or too old or whatever. I got sober when I was 23, and I'm going to be celebrating 25 years May the 18th if I make it. I will tell you this, that it was really the grace of God and some very valuable people in this program that helped me. And so this is I was about 10 or 11 years sober. Things were falling apart. All the people that I had gotten sober with were getting loaded and drunk, and I knew I had to change, and I found a new, I met this guy, Clint Hodges. He's part of this group in L.A. called the Pacific Group. They're a really big, hardcore group. And I asked him to be my sponsor, and after some banter back and forth, he agreed, and we started working the steps, he gave me this set-aside prayer, and it sounded like this. It was, please, dear God, please let me set aside everything I think I know about you, about this program, about these steps, for an open mind and a new idea about you, about me, about this program, and about these steps. And that was the journey I was to go on. Not to throw away everything I think I knew, just to set it aside for a new idea. And we had been working together for about a year, and one day he said, you know, Patrick, I can't help you anymore. I'm like, why? He goes, because I'm not going to be another one of the failed male authority figures in your life. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, I think you know what I'm talking about. We're done. I'm like, what? He said, look, all right, if you want me to work with you, here's what you're going to have to do. You've got to forgive your dad. I never told him, Jack, diddly squat about my dad. This guy just knew it. You know the old time AAs? They just kind of like know. They look at you and like, it kind of, he would do this. He'd look into my eyes like, dude, don't look into my soul. But he did that. And he said, you need to forgive your dad. I'm thinking anything but that. But I had to admit I was getting a lot of progress with this guy. I made a lot of things were happening for me. But I didn't say anything. He goes, all right, how about this? He goes, would you be willing to forgive him? All right, now, new folks, listen up, all right, because this is an AA old-timer trick. Don't fall for it. I said, yeah, I'll be willing. He goes, good. Willingness without action is fantasy. Here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to, there's going to be a retreat, and I want you to go to this retreat, and on Saturday night there's going to be a forgiveness exercise, and I want you to take part in it. And that retreat is in 3 weeks, so for the next 3 weeks I want you to pray to your 9-volt battery gods, if that's about the juice you're pulling from your higher power, and for the strength and the willingness to forgive your dad. So for the next 3 weeks I pray to my 9-volt battery god, dear God, please help me to forgive my dad, blah, 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 blah. And I got there, and it's at the Mary Joseph Retreat Center in Palo Verde. I was living in Long Beach at the time. I'm thinking, gee, I can't get away from the Catholics, you know? And then he pulls out this thing, and it's from Emmett Fox, all right? And it's from the Sermon on the Mount. Oh, the Bible. Oh, come on, give me a break. And then it's like the worst part. It's in the back of the Sermon on the Mount, and it's the Our Father, the prayer I hate. We shouldn't say that at AA. This is my stance. That prayer doesn't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. Blah, 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 blah. That's what I thought, right? And in the back of this Sermon on the Mount that Emmett Fox wrote about, and he's got the Our Father broken down into all... The guy was a prolific writer. And in it, he takes this one section out, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And from that, those two little sentences, he wrote like 8 pages. This guy had a lot of time on his hands, obviously. And inside of that writing was the actual forgiveness exercise. And it sounded like this. I fully and freely forgive the whole business. And then you put in the name of the person. So I'm sitting in that chair, and there's like 7 or 8 of us in there. It's dark. It's late. I'm tired. And here I am. I fully and freely forgive my dad, the whole business. And I'll tell you something. This was my experience. Something happened for me. It did. I felt like a weight had lifted off of my back. I did. And then Clint said, is there anybody else you want to forgive? I'm like, all right, my mom. She should have protected me, right? This is what my thinking. All right. I fully and freely forgive my mom. I'm feeling lighter. Is there anybody else you want to forgive? All right. I start going through everybody because I'm a victim, see? And so I set up all my relationships to be a victim. I set them up that way because I want to prove to myself and to everybody else, see? You can't trust anybody. And that's how I had all my relationships set up. And that's what Clint was saying in the very beginning, that he couldn't help me anymore because he could feel I was setting that relationship up for failure. And here I am. I'm forgiving everybody. And I feel like I'm at like some Christian retreat and I'm getting high on Jesus or something. I don't know, man, because I feel like my ass isn't even touching the chair. I'm feeling so light. And by this time, everybody else had gone. It's Clint and I, chair to chair, knee to knee, and I'm having this experience. And he goes, is there anybody else or anything else you want to forgive? And see, this is what happened. I think I was in like third or fourth grade. I was in church one day, and the priest said, you can go to God with anything. And I remember, I said, okay, all right, I'll give it a shot. Dear God, please make it stop. I'm 8 or 9 years old. Please, God, make it stop. And it didn't. In fact, I think it got worse. And so here I am, fast forward, 30 years later. All right, Clint, there is somebody else I want to forgive, something else. Like, shoot. All right, I fully and freely forgive God. The whole business. That's crazy, forgiving God, really. But here's what it felt like. It felt like I had shut the curtains. I had, you know, Chuck C. talks about that, sunlight of the spirit. I had shut my curtains. I had put tinfoil on them. I was like a tweaker in my little kingdom, right? And when I had forgiven God, suddenly the curtains were open, the tinfoil was ripped off, and the light was shining on me, and I felt it. I felt a power that I cannot adequately express in words. I will tell you that something happened to me. And that relationship with my higher power became open at that point. And I felt like I could do anything. I slept so good that night. The next morning, I'm up at like 6:30. I go and knock on Clint's door. He answers the door. I go, good morning. He's like, oh, bam, he shut the door, right? And I walked away. I don't care. You're not going to make me down. I'm happy. He opens the door. He goes, it's Mother's Day. Call your mom. Now, I want you to know, at about 3 years sober, I tried to make amends to my parents, and it went sideways on me. It went sideways because I never forgave them. And here's what happened. I got in the middle of the amends, and all of a sudden I look at my dad, and I can just see the eyes, and the hate started to fill up, and words were said back and forth. Horrible things. And I did not talk to them for 10 years, for the next 10 years. So Clint told me that it was Mother's Day to call my mom. I had not talked to my mom in 10 years. I mean, I'm talking Christmases, Thanksgivings, all those things went by. And so I get on the phone, and I call my mom up. And she answers the phone and said, "Hi, Mom, it's Patrick." "Oh, Patrick, are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, Mom, I'm fine. I called to wish you a happy Mother's Day." "Oh, we have missed you so much." I go, "I know, Mom. I've missed you too." And that's how it went. That was the conversation. Because I had tried to call before. I wanted to. But what I did was, I never made it to the phone because I'm saying, she says this, I'm going to say that. If my dad comes on the phone, I'm going to say this. And if he says that, I'm going to say this. Now, I'm like, I let them off the hook. See, the thing is, I let everybody off the hook. I set them free. But you know who I really set free? Me. I set me free. Weirdest thing. You know, I was a jailer, but there was no, I was in jail, but there were no COs, there were no guards. I was a self-made prison. I had the key the whole time. And I unlocked that key with a little willingness to forgive. I opened that door and I walked out of that prison and I was able to fully make amends to my mom and dad. It took a couple of years, okay? And, I want to tell about the amends to my dad and, with my father. And Clint had me write all the 3x5 cards out, the exact nature of my wrong, and then ask that all-important question, which is our marching orders, what can I do to make it right? And here's what I did. Here was my part in this. This is what I could never see. I could only see his part in it. See, a good righteous resentment, you can never see your part. The ego won't let you see your part. All right? So here was my part in it. Every time I had a chance, I would embarrass him. I never believed a word he said. If he was in the middle of the conversation, I would cut him off. I would. I'd just cut him off and start talking. Change the subject, do whatever. I mean, it had to be frustrating for him. And I told him that. And he sat across the table from me at this coffee shop, and he started to cry, and he said, "I am so sorry." And I asked him, "What can I do to make it right?" Well, about 3 or 4 months before that, my daughter was born, and he said, I want you to be the best father you can to your daughter." My daughter's name is Dorothy, like the Wizard of Oz. I know, we got all those. And it was the grandmother's name, and it means gift of God. We didn't know that's what it meant. We named her, and then we found out later on it means gift of God. And so he said, "I want you to be the best father you can be to Dorothy." And I said, "Okay." And then he did this crazy thing. He handed me this tape, all right? And on it, it said, "Sexaholics Anonymous World Convention." It had his name on it. And I left there. I made the same amends with my mom. And she told me the exact same thing, and I made them separately. They never had time to talk to each other. It's amazing how close those two were. And I put that tape in the car. And I listened to it, and it was my dad. It was my dad sharing, just like I'm sharing to you guys. But it was a bunch of sexaholics. And he was sharing our story. He was sharing my story. And I got to tell you, I could not believe the similarities of alcoholism to what he was going through. He wanted to stop, but couldn't. He felt the guilt and remorse, all of it. And then the last vestiges of resentment just went away because I saw him as a sick man. And I thought, how can I value my sobriety if I can't value his recovery? And 2 years ago, I got a call from him on Christmas night, and he was hysterical. And I could hardly understand what he was saying, but I heard it. I didn't want to hear it. He said that your mom has had a heart attack and died. And I just thought, man. I go, "What can I do?" And he said, "I don't know." And we both cried, and we talked, her wishes were to have her ashes scattered out at Big Sur, and he drove out here, and he and I did that together. I gave the eulogy at her funeral, and that was a hard thing. It was. So here I am with my father, who's about half a foot shorter than I am. He's crying like a little baby. And we put these ashes out into the ocean, and I'm holding him, and I'm comforting him. A guy that I hated, a guy that I would wish a thousand deaths on, that forgiveness just healed it. You know, that's what really Alcoholics Anonymous does a lot of things. And when we get sober, it's so much more than that. We get our lives back. We get our families back if we want them. You know, it's like I came in here, I just wanted a little relief. That's all. What I got was freedom. You know, last night, my daughter came in and she's like, "Daddy, would you read to me? Mama reads to me." And I'm like, "I'm really busy right now, honey." She goes, "But Dad, I love my daddy." That's her little thing. You know, she got me. I'm like, "All right," you know. And she's got a pink room, the princesses on the walls, you know, and the princess pillows, and Mr. Noodles, the pink dachshund, is right there. And she goes, "Well, here, I want you to read me these songs, but you're not going to sing them. You're going to read them in a whisper." I'm like, "Okay." And she says, "You'll have to read about 60 of them before I go to sleep." Thinking, Jesus, you know, like, okay. And, Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. Everywhere that Mary went, about 10 of them I read. They were songs, you know, and, she was out. You know, I'm her hero. And, we went to the father-daughter dance. That's Valentine's. First time we went, she was extremely excited about it. I was mildly excited. I'm pretty sure they're not going to have a mosh pit at the Lompoc father-daughter dance. And I only know how to slam dance. And so we got there. She was about 4 at the time. And she's got her little hand in mine, and the music just was loud. There's a lot of people that got the spinning globe because Lompoc is stuck in the 70s, and with the light on it, and it's dark, and she's afraid, and we walk in there, and all of a sudden they play a song that she knows, and we're dancing. And then they played a slow song, and I'm too fat to lean over, so I picked her up, and we're dancing, and her hair is back, and she looked at me and she said, "Daddy, I love you. And I want you to know, man." I'm like, you know, I'm like, and I was glad it was dark in there. Have you ever seen that Verizon Wireless commercial with the guy who's got the network behind him? You know, those people falling? That's what it was like, except it was you guys. It was Alcoholics Anonymous. And you were all behind me. And you said, "Yes, this is what it's about. It's about being a father. It's about being a son. It's about being a brother and an employee and an employer and a friend and all those things that we just cut ourselves off from. And all that loneliness has just evaporated. And my daughter loves me so much, it's overwhelming." She does. It is just overwhelming to me. And I love her. And my wife, oh, she's amazing. She is. She's so beautiful. I'm just glad she's blind, you know, because she is just stunning. She is. And my life is so wonderful. I just wanted to stop drinking. That was it. I'm going to close with this. It's called the ballsy paragraph. It's what Clint called it. And it's for those big book technicians. It's on page 25. And he always had me read this in first person, and I really like it. "The great fact is just this and nothing less, that I have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized my whole attitude toward life, toward my fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of my life today is the absolute certainty that my Creator has entered into my heart and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for me which I could never do by myself." Thank you.